God is with us, no matter in what situation we might be. If you go through a valley of death, if you go through surging and scourging fire, through howling wind, through overflowing water, God is right there with us. God works in our lives in mysterious ways. And he brings about events which we would not have believed to be possible. We find a very vivid, a very compelling example in the life of Joseph, one of the sons, of course, of Jacob, or Israel. I'd like to go through the life of Joseph today, and at the same time, I want to ask you to ask yourselves some questions. What would you have done? And how does Joseph's life can be an inspiration for you, especially if you're still young, but also, of course, if you are as old as I am and maybe even older than that. Let's start with Genesis chapter 37. I'm not going to read all the scriptures here. I'd like to summarize some of them and hit some highlights. But in Genesis 37, we read about Joseph. We read in verse 2 that he was 17 years old when all of this transpired. 17, that's not very, very old. But of course, you know, Joseph's still young. Whenever his brothers and half-brothers did something, he brought the bad report of them to his father. And so the brothers didn't like that too much. And so then, on top of that, he had dreams, and he told the dreams to his father, his mother, his brothers, and the brothers hated him even more for that. And so we read in verse 5 of chapter 37 that Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. And then he talked about the fact that he has seen them binding sheaves in the field, verse 7. And then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And of course the brother said, what does that mean? You know, are we supposed to be submissive to you? Are you going to rule over us? And then they had another dream, verse 9. And he told his brothers and said, I have dreamt another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. And so he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream that you have dreamt? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? So they realized what these dreams which Joseph had dreamt could have meant. You might want to later look at a passage in Revelation 12 and verse 1 where a very similar picture is given. Now, I like to point out that some of what Joseph had dreamt came true, but not all of it. No indication that his mother ever bowed down to him, not even his father. The brothers, however, did, as we will see. When we go on with the story, we find that now the brothers hated him so much that when Joseph was sent by Jacob to look after them, they decided, first of all, to kill him. And then it was Reuben who prevented that from happening. And he said, no, let us not kill him. And they put him in a pit, and Reuben was actually thinking of freeing him from that pit. But in the meantime, Judah said, okay, well, why don't we just sell him, making some money out of it? And so that's what they did. Apparently, Reuben wasn't there when it happened. When he came back, Joseph was gone. They sold him as a slave to the Ishmaelites. And the Ishmaelites brought him to Egypt as a slave. And the brothers lied to the father Jacob, telling him that Joseph must have been killed by a wild animal. So now the question is, 17-year-old boy being sold by his own brothers to the Ishmaelites, the Midianites, who then brought him to Egypt. Where's God? Did God completely and totally forget about me? Did he forsake me? Where's God? It looked pretty hopeless for him, didn't it? Now, interestingly enough, he's being sold to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And in chapter 39, we find that because of Joseph, Potiphar and his household is blessed mightily. God blessed the household because of Joseph. But then something happened. Potiphar's wife tried to have a sexual relationship with Joseph, was a good-looking young boy. Joseph refused to accept the offer. In chapter 39 and in verse 9 we read, 39:9. "There is no one greater in this house than I," Joseph said, "nor has he," that's the father, I mean the husband of his wife, "nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Joseph understood that ultimately sin is against God. Why? Because God is the lawgiver. God is the one who is telling us how to live, what to do, what not to do. And adultery was wrong. Now, interestingly enough, this was stated long before the Ten Commandments were revealed or reiterated to the Israelites under Moses. The reason being the Ten Commandments were enforced in effect from the day God created Adam and Eve. So Joseph did the right thing. He fled. Then the story is being told about him by this devious wife that he allegedly had tried to attack her, to violate her. What's happening? The husband believes his wife, and Joseph is thrown into jail. Again, where was God? I mean, here Joseph did the right thing, and as a result, as a reward, he was thrown into jail. Now, do you think that Joseph might have thought a little bit about what's going on in my life here? First, I'm being innocently sold as a slave to Egypt, and then I am standing up for God and his law, and sure enough, I'm ending up in jail. Now, all these things, as we will see, had a bearing, were important. So he's now in jail, and again, God blesses his work in jail. And so everything is being turned over to him pretty much. And it's also becoming known, as we will see now, that Joseph not only dreamt dreams, but he could also, with the help of God, interpret dreams. We want to read first in chapter 39 and in verse 21, where it says, "But the Lord was with Joseph, even in jail, and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison." Verse 23, "The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, even in jail. God was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper." So no matter what situation was Joseph in, God was with him. God helped him. And then we read in chapter 40 that there were two guys, a butler and a baker, and they were thrown in jail because of some problems they had created. And then they had dreams. And Joseph saw that something troubled them. He asked them, well, now, what happened? And so they tell him the dreams. First, it was the one who would later then reward it. In chapter 40 and verse 8, we read, "They said to him, we have each dreamed a dream, or dreamt a dream. There is no interpreter of it. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God?" So he understood that. It wasn't his own understanding which gave him the ability to interpret dreams. No, he knew it came from God. But he says, well, tell them to me, please. And so first the butler tells him what he dreamt. And so Joseph interprets the dream, saying, oh, this means in 3 days you will be back in your place in front of Pharaoh. And then, of course, the baker also told him his dream, and that was a bad one. And so Joseph tells him in verse 19, within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you. And so Joseph told the butler, now when you are being released in 3 days, don't forget me, because I'm here in this jail totally innocently. But as human nature goes, the butler was brought back to Pharaoh, and he forgot about Joseph. Didn't mention anything about Joseph at all. And here's Joseph in prison, wondering, when do I hear something? 2 years go by. Nothing happened. 2 years in prison. Joseph must be wondering, when do I ever get out of here? And then something happens. Pharaoh has a dream. In chapter 41, actually he has two dreams. And of course, these are the two famous dreams. He saw these seven fine-looking cows, fat cows. And then he saw these ugly cows. They were also described as skeleton-like. And so these seven ugly cows swallowed up and ate the fine-looking ones. And then he also had another dream that Pharaoh, and he saw seven heads of grain, good-looking. And then there were also seven heads of other grain, very badly looking, and those badly looking ones swallowed up, devoured the seven plump and full heads. And of course, Pharaoh is very concerned. He wakes up. He's wondering what this is all about. And now comes the guy who had forgotten Joseph, that's chief butler, and he says, you know, now I have to tell you something. I forgotten about it, but there was somebody in prison, and I remember how he interpreted our dreams, and he was completely correct. And so Joseph is brought before Pharaoh, and he explains to him the dream, both dreams. And he said, well, you dreamt it twice, which means God is going to carry it out. Let's go back a little. If Joseph wouldn't have ended up in jail, if Joseph wouldn't have had the opportunity to interpret the dreams of the butler and the other guy, and if then the butler wouldn't have remembered that Joseph had told them and interpreted the dreams correctly, none of what has happened now would have happened. Even if Pharaoh would have had these dreams, nobody would have been there to interpret those dreams to him. So the point is, Joseph had to be in that prison. He had to be interpreting those dreams so that he could then be brought in front of Pharaoh to show him what Pharaoh had dreamt. And of course, the meaning of the dreams were clear. There would be 7 years of tremendous prosperity, and then there would be 7 years of famine. And so then Joseph said to Pharaoh, okay, now find somebody who is doing the right thing insofar as what should be done. And so here's the interesting answer by Pharaoh in chapter 41 and verse 38. Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? So he recognized that God's Spirit was in this person, Joseph, and so that God was working with Joseph. And so, of course, then Joseph takes preparations for storing the grain for the 7 years of prosperity so that they would have enough when the 7 years of hunger and famine would come. But there is something else which chapter 41 tells us in verse 45. Genesis 41 and verse 45. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Sapnath-Pirneah, and he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And so Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt, and he was 30 years old. Now, remember, he was 17 when he was brought to Pharaoh. Maybe stayed there for Egypt, I should say. Maybe he stayed there for a few months, and he was sent to jail up until he was 30 years old. Long time. I'm sure he must have asked himself the question, what is happening here, and is God with me? But now, there is an interesting situation developing insofar as that princess is concerned. He is marrying, and some have said this was a pagan princess, and it was the daughter of a pagan minister. So how could Joseph marry that person? Now we have a Q&A on it. The title is, why did Joseph marry Asenath, the daughter of an Egyptian priest? Didn't this violate God's instructions against marrying a pagan non-believer? And of course it would have. It clearly would have. But we are giving some interesting possible explanations. Some propose, we say, that Potipera, the father, and Asenath were not pagan worshippers. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown states, Joseph's naturalization was completed by his alliance with a family of high distinction. On being founded by an Arab colony, Potipharah, like Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, priest of Midian, might be a worshiper of the true God. And thus Joseph, a pious man, will be freed from the charge of marrying an adulteress for worldly ends. And so, in addition, this father might not have been a priest at all. Because we also point out, and the Sonsino commentary points it out, that the word for priest, as it's translated here, can also mean ruler. And it's translated as ruler in certain other passages, like in 2 Samuel 8 and verse 18. So he might not have been working in a religious function. He might have been working in some kind of a political function. He was not the ruler. The ruler was Pharaoh. He was a ruler under Pharaoh. So this is definitely a very reasonable explanation. And the next question then is, were they even Egyptians? Because that would have been a violation too, if Joseph would have married an Egyptian. And again, some commentaries point out, no, they were not Egyptians. They were also from the same race as Joseph, and they were just living there only, like others have migrated to that place as well. If we go on with the story, we find a little later that two sons were born to him in chapter 41 and verse 50. To Joseph were born two sons before the years of famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, so he was the firstborn, and he called the name of the second Ephraim. So remember that, Manasseh was the firstborn. Ephraim was the secondborn. Ephraim and Manasseh were children of Joseph and the daughter of this priest or ruler of On. Now we will read a lot about Ephraim and Manasseh, or heard a lot about them. It doesn't appear that they were half Israelite and half Egyptian. That wouldn't make a lot of sense if you think about it as to what's prophesied about Ephraim and Manasseh. In chapter 42, we read, beginning in verse 1, that, of course, the famine, which had started, also affected Jacob and his family. And they were really plagued by that. And so Jacob then sends his sons to Egypt. He said, I've heard that there is food. We don't have any. So why don't you just go to Egypt? But he didn't send Benjamin. Now, Benjamin was his youngest son, born after Joseph. He didn't send him. He said, well, if something happens to him, after I lost Joseph already, woe would be me. And so he didn't send Benjamin. Now, when they come to Joseph, Joseph recognized them right away as his brothers. However, they did not recognize him. And so Joseph now is beginning to test them. And he says, you're spies, and you're just coming here to spy us out. And so then he's asking more and more questions, and so they reveal to him, yes, there are more brothers, and one has died, they say, and the other one is left behind. And so Joseph then, trying to find out how sincere, how honest, how righteous or unrighteous they were, said, okay, now I'm giving you the food, but you have to leave somebody here, one of your brothers has to stay here, Simeon, and when you come back, you bring Benjamin with you, because that will be the proof to me that you are honest people. And so he also gives them the money back, they don't know that, put the money for the food in the sack, and so they leave, and they come home, and they see, oh, here's the money in the bag. And so they said, well, now we have to go back, to free Simeon, we have to go back with Benjamin. But Jacob said, no, Benjamin is going to stay here. You're not going to go back. Until the point comes where they need again food. And then he says, okay, go back and buy some more food. And they said, we can't do that. Because we have said, unless we bring the Pharaoh, I mean the person, acting for the Pharaoh, I said, unless you bring Benjamin, don't come back. And so after some persuasion, Jacob agrees, so they take Benjamin, and they take extra money and extra gifts for the one who acted on Pharaoh's behalf. Okay, the tests are not done yet, because now Joseph is doing something else. In chapter 44, he sends them back, putting again the money in the bags, but he does something else. Chapter 44 and verse 1. And he commanded the steward of the house, saying, fill the man's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money in the mouth of his sack. Also put my cup, the silver cup, in the mouth of the sack of the youngest, Benjamin, and his grain money. And so he did according to the words that Joseph had spoken. And then, of course, they are leaving, and right after they have left, the Egyptians pursue them. And we read that the following is said to them in verse 5. Is not this the one from which my Lord drinks? Talking about this cup. And with which he indeed practices divination. You have done evil in so doing. And they say, oh, we haven't done this. No way, why would we steal silver or gold? I mean, after he gave us all that food and so on. And then the Egyptians say, okay, in whose sack the cup is found, he will become a prisoner of Pharaoh, and the rest of you can go. And so in verse 12, it says, so he searched, and he began with the oldest and left off with the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. And then they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. And so Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said to them, what deed is this you have done? Did you not know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination? And then he said, okay, and so Benjamin will now be my slave. And as you read on, you find that it is Judah, the one who originally had proposed to just sell Joseph, that he stands up for Benjamin and says, no, take me as your slave, but let Benjamin go because I gave my word to Jacob that Benjamin would be brought back. He says in verse 32, for your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I shall bear the blame before my father forever. And now therefore, please let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. And of course, that showed Joseph that they were sincere. But before we go on, we need to talk a little bit about that cup of divination. Did Joseph practice divination, sorcery, witchcraft? Because that's how this word can be translated. The Hebrew word is nachash. And it can mean use enchantment. In the King James, it talks about divination, enchantment, sorcery, and so on. Now, the concept that Joseph, this righteous man with whom God dealt. And he had become the number two in Egypt, that he would have practiced demonic divination. It's even difficult for commentaries to accept. I mean, after all, Joseph is mentioned as one of the faithful patriarchs who will receive the promise of eternal life. Hebrews points that out. We have again an update on this one, a Q&A. Did Joseph practice divination? And so, just hitting some highlights, many commentaries conclude that in order to test his brothers, Joseph did not practice divination, but he pretended to do so, that he did not dispute the superstition attached to his cup. Now, that would be almost as bad as practicing divination himself, you know, resorting to a lie. That is not really a reasonable conclusion. And so some have pointed out that the word nachash, which can mean divination, can also have different meanings, one of which is to diligently observe, to diligently observe, as the Strong's encyclopedia puts it. The Benson commentary writes, when it says, whereby indeed he practiced divination, the original word may be rendered for which he would search thoroughly. You see, what we're talking about is Joseph was looking after the cup, the object of the search. He was searching for that cup. And again, Jill's exposition of the entire Bible says, it seems best to understand this not of the cup as the instrument by which he tried, searched, and inquired into things, but as the object searched after and inquired of. In other words, diligent inquiry was made after it, after the cup. And so we find several scriptures, as we point out in our update, where the word is differently translated. Like one is, I learned by experience, not I practiced divination, I learned by experience, or I watched closely. That's another scripture where it's translated that way. And even if you look at some of the German translations, it's interesting how they put it. They would some would say Joseph was able to discern, or he would certainly find it out, or he could figure it out. So in conclusion, as we say in our update, Joseph had his valuable cup placed in Benjamin's sack to test the brothers, thereby whether they would forsake Benjamin, as they had forsaken Joseph, or whether they would stand by him. The cup was not a cup through which or by which Joseph divined or searched the future, but it was the object which was lost and for which Joseph was searching. And it was the object by which the brothers were being tested or examined as to whether they would be loyal to Benjamin and the father Jacob. So there's really no possible conclusion that Joseph, a righteous man, would have engaged in divination or sorcery or witchcraft. And after Judah had stood up for Benjamin and had said, okay, now then keep me as a slave, but let Benjamin go, Joseph is so overwhelmed that he is then revealing himself. In chapter 45 and verse 1, we read, then Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried out, make everyone go out from me. And so no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard it. You see, there is nothing wrong with having emotions. Some people say, oh, as a Christian man, you should never show your emotion, you should never weep, you should never... It's nonsense. Jesus Christ wept when he was at the grave of Lazarus. Here Joseph wept. And then, of course, he tells his brothers, come to me, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. And then he says in verse 5, very important now, but now do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. Notice how Joseph looked at all the circumstances in his life and concluded it was all directed by God, that he was sold into slavery, that he ended up in prison, that he was able to tell the Pharaoh the dreams, that then he was put in charge of storing food. Why? To preserve life. To preserve the life of Jacob and of the brothers, as well as, of course, many Egyptians and others who came to buy the food. It says in verse 6, "For these 2 years a famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting." Verse 7, "And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." And then he tells him, "Go and get Jacob so that he and his household can come down as well." I don't think that Joseph, when he was 17 years old, the boy who was sold into slavery, had any clue as to what would come out of him. But when he was 30, after many years, the developments became more and more obvious to him. And now he's making the connection, saying, well, this all had to happen. It had to happen so that Jacob and the brothers and many other people were safe, could survive. Now, we also find in chapter 46 some interesting comments here, because then Jacob comes down with his household. It says, with all his descendants. You read that in verse 7, all his son's sons and his daughters and his son's daughters and so on, all his descendants. But notice who was part of that in verse 13. And the sons of Issachar, one of his sons, they were Tola, Puva, Job, and Shimron. Job. We have heard of Job, haven't we? The famous person who is reported, who is writing, who is speaking a lot in the book of Job. So Issachar was the father of Job, which means Job was the nephew of Jacob. Or to put it differently, Joseph was Job's uncle. A close family relationship. Joseph was Job's uncle. Now, you've all heard about the Cheops pyramid. It's actually spelled Cheops, and in the Hebrew you can also pronounce it, and you are pronouncing it Cheops. In German, the word Job is Hiob. Very close. We're talking about the pyramid of Gizeh. We're talking about the Great Pyramid. Cheops was also known as Khufu, K-H-U-F-U, which according to the internet, it's the old Egyptian term for Cheops. Now there's an old article written by Herman Hay, Who Built the Great Pyramid? And I'd like to just take a few excerpts from it for the purpose of this sermon today. He's asking the question, who was Cheops or Khufu? And then, first of all, according to records, Khufu or Cheops or Cheops was of a different race than the Egyptians. So he had arrived in Egypt, but coming from a different race. It also says, according to Herodotus, that Cheops was not a polytheist. He was a worshiper of the one God. Cheops closed the temples and prohibited the Egyptians from offering sacrifices, is being reported. We also find that a noted man who helped Cheops in building the pyramid was a person with the name of Souf, S-O-U-F. Now, not much is known about this person. He seems to be clouded in mysteries somewhat when you look at the records, but he is referred to as one of 12 brothers. He is the one who helped Cheops to build the pyramid. It is also reported that that person lived 110 years, and then he died. And of course, we know that Joseph was 110 years when he died, and he was one of 12 brothers. So putting this all together, it appears that it was Job who built the pyramid with the help of Joseph, his uncle. Now, there's also some reference in the book of Job, and later on, God talks to him, and he says, you know, where were you when I founded the earth? And he makes some parallels between building a pyramid and founding the earth. And, of course, that makes a lot of sense if Job, in fact, was the one who built the Great Pyramid, which, by the way, was not built for the purpose of somebody being buried there. No remains have been found at all in that pyramid. So why do I bring this up? I bring this up because think in terms of Joseph, the 17-year-old guy, that boy, the shepherd boy. He might very well have been involved together with Job to build the pyramid, a big mystery which is still not clear yet to most scholars as to what that pyramid is all about, why it was built. I mean, there are so many mysteries still involved with this. I mean, you can't even get into some of these chambers inside. Think in terms of a young boy and what became out of him. But there's even more what we can say about him. Because in chapter 48, Genesis 48, and verse 1. And put yourself in that situation. Ask yourself about your own life if you are still young. What is God going to do with my life? And if you're older, what has God already done with my life? And what is still in store for me? In chapter 48 and verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, indeed your father is sick. And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And of course, then what Jacob is doing, he is adopting these two sons. We read in verse 5, and now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. See, Reuben and Simeon were one of his two sons, and so he adopts Ephraim and Manasseh as being also part of his sons. And we also read in verse 10 that he had become blind, he couldn't see anymore. And so Joseph places the two sons in front of Jacob to bless him. And normally you would take your right hand and bless the head of the firstborn, and you would take the left hand and you would bless the head of the second child. But Jacob does it the opposite. He actually crosses his hands and his arms, and he places his right hand of the younger, Ephraim, and gives him the firstborn blessing. And when Joseph sees this, he says, oh no, my father, no, you put your right hand on the firstborn, Manasseh. And so we read now in verse 13 of chapter 48. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near. Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And then Joseph said to his father in verse 18, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head. And in verse 19, the father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, talking about Manasseh, and he shall be great. But truly his younger brother Ephraim shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude, or you could also translate a commonwealth of nations. In other words, a prophecy is being given to the two sons of Joseph. And as we all should know today, we find the descendants of Manasseh in the United States of America, the greatest one, single nation, as some have said, which has ever existed. But then you also find the descendants of Ephraim in the British Commonwealth, the United Kingdom, and all the other countries of English descent, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, used to be Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe, many others. All from the loins, if you please, of a 17-year-old shepherd boy. And all of this was guided and directed by God, including this particular blessing. Now let me ask you this. First of all, why did actually Joseph get the firstborn blessing? He wasn't the firstborn. It was Reuben. Reuben was the firstborn. So why didn't Jacob bless Reuben with the firstborn blessing rather than Ephraim and Manasseh, in this case Ephraim? Well, in Genesis chapter 49 and verse 3, we read something about Reuben. Genesis 49 and verse 3. And this is what Jacob actually tells him. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water, in other words, not reliable. You shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, and then you defiled it, and he went up to my couch. Now what happened? What happened is that Reuben had an adulterous affair with Rachel's maid, Bilhah, which was a concubine, of course, of Jacob, and so he defiled Jacob. And as a consequence of this action, we read the following in 1 Chronicles, chapter 5. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 and in verse 1. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. So Reuben lost his birthright. He lost the birthright blessing. They were given to Joseph. I dare to say that God had intended that from the outset, that Joseph would be the recipient of the firstborn and the firstborn blessing. Now, God didn't make Reuben to do what he did, because we also have other examples. For instance, Esau and Jacob. Esau was the firstborn, but due to his conduct, because he despised the firstborn, he despised the blessing, Jacob received first the firstborn, the birthright, and he also received the blessing of the birthright. But you see, God had intended that from the outset, not in the way that Reuben acted, but he said even before the two boys were born, read that in the book of Romans, I have loved the one and hated the other. In other words, I have loved the one in the sense that he would be the one who would receive my blessings. And so here we have something similar. You know, Reuben received the birthright and the blessing, and then another switch occurred. For whatever reason, God decided it would be not the firstborn Manasseh who would receive the greater blessings, but it would be Ephraim. And so this is exactly what has happened. So again, God has worked all these things out for a reason. But the point I want to make today is that it was Joseph who became the recipient of the birthright blessings due to what Reuben had done, but that was designed by God from the outset. Now, tremendous blessings were given. Tremendous blessings were given to Joseph. But there's also a warning attached, and you can read about this later in the book of Amos, chapter 3 and verse 3. Because there, the warning is, Amos chapter 6 and verse 6. The blessings can be taken away. We read there that the people are not grieved for the afflictions of Joseph. And that is what we are happening and what we are seeing today. People don't care. Neither in the United States of America, nor in Great Britain, the United Kingdom, and the other English-speaking nations. We have a booklet out there, The Fall and Rise of Britain and America. The descendants of Joseph will fall. It's prophesied. But then they will rise again when Jesus Christ returns. When we go back to the story, we find that then Jacob dies, he is being buried, and we also find that after Jacob has died, the brothers are very concerned what Joseph may do now. And so we read in verse 15 of chapter 50, Genesis 50 and verse 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him. And though they sent messengers to Joseph saying, before your father died, he commanded saying, thus you shall say to Joseph. Now, whether that was entirely true is a story all by itself, or whether they made that up. But in any event, they said, Jacob told us to say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they said that. And then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, behold, we are your servants. And Joseph said to them, verse 19, do not be afraid, for I am in the place of God, or am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me. And how many times do we experience that people try to harm us, try to do really evil against us? That's what they want to do. But he goes on to say, but God meant it for good. Whatever God allows in our lives is for a reason. God meant it for good, he says, in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid, and I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. And then he also told them, I'm going to die, and when I'm going to die, take my bones, and when you leave Egypt, you will leave Egypt to go to the promised land, take my bones with you. And that's exactly what happened. You can read that in Exodus chapter 13 and in verse 19. And in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 22, this is another example given there for the faith of Joseph. Joseph had the faith, he had the confidence, he had the conviction that the Israelites would leave Egypt after they had been slaves there for many, many years, and they would take Joseph's bones with them, which they did. It's a tremendous story of somebody who started very, very modestly, so to speak, as a young shepherd boy, ending up as the second most respected and most powerful man in the entire kingdom of Egypt, and maybe was even involved in building the Cheops pyramids, and blessings were given to him, to his sons, which would survive until the time of Jesus Christ's return and thereafter. But I'd like to conclude with a statement in the book of Psalms, because there we find that God even did more than what we have just read about. And as I said earlier, no matter what happens in our lives, no matter whether it's a storm we have to go through or fire or flooding, God is there to help us. God is there to protect us. But not only that, God is there to use us for his purpose. In Psalm 105, let's read this in conclusion about Joseph, beginning in verse 16. And never forget that you are called today to become an immortal member in the family of God, a spirit being, a God being. I mean, even when I look at the physical blessings Joseph received, how much more will our spiritual blessings be? Of course, Joseph will have those too. But in Psalm 105 and verse 16, moreover, he, that is God, He called for a famine in the land. It was God who did it. He called a famine for the land or in the land. He destroyed all the provision of bread. And he sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. They hurt his feet with fetters. He was laid in irons. I mean, a terrible time it had to be for him, wondering what was going on. Verse 19, until the time that his word came to pass. There was a time element involved. And it had to last that long until God intervened. Until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. He was being tested during this time. How would he react? What would he do? How would he accept what was happening in his life? Verse 20, the king sent and released him. The ruler of the people let him go free. And he, God, made him lord of his house, of course, so did Pharaoh, and ruler of all his possessions, to bind his princes at his pleasure and to teach his elders wisdom. That's what Joseph did as well. He taught the elders of Pharaoh godly wisdom. He was also used in that capacity. And then we read in verse 23, and Israel also came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. So you see, God did all of that. I'm not sure that Joseph understood that all throughout his life. He probably didn't, but God did. And when we sometimes go through terrible times, it is easy to forget that God is there to help us. But as he did in the life of Joseph, so he is doing that in our lives as well.